Would you join with me in prayer?
May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, so Jackson and I recently bought a house, which means that for the first time ever, we have a guest room to furnish. So yesterday, we drove down to Charlotte to visit IKEA, where we had identified a suitable bed and nightstand and dresser. I'm not usually a very patient shopper or a very pleasant person to be around on days like this. But yesterday, I think I did a fairly good job. You know, once you master the specially trademarked Dewey Decimal System in the warehouse, you can easily find all of IKEA's furniture there. But the problem is that if you go to IKEA for just three things, you know, a bed, a nightstand, and a dresser, it's impossible to leave with just three things. Because IKEA is not like any department store, you know, where you can go in, you know, with a special mission and go to one department, like the Oxford shirt section or the hand towels, and leave with what you need. No, IKEA requires their customers to experience the whole realm of Scandinavian housewares. I call it the lazy river to needless consumption. You float through every department in the store, not just once, but twice. First through the showrooms upstairs, then after a brief feeding on Swedish meatballs, through all the shopping racks downstairs. And the most advanced IKEA customers know a few shortcuts. You know, they've already found those little tributaries that can make it possible to miss entire sections of the lazy river. But I've never bothered to learn those shortcuts because every time I go to IKEA, I pray it will be my last time to go to IKEA. And by the time you make it to that warehouse where you can actually find the things that you came to take home with you, you've picked up 1,000 smaller items that you don't actually need. Silicone trays to freeze ice cubes in the shape of stars. Mixing bowls that nest like Russian dolls. A felt box to hold dog toys. Yesterday, we briefly considered purchasing 100 matching coat hangers to replace all the coat hangers that don't match in the closet that has a door. Thank goodness we came to our senses and saved $4. The lazy river is full of little nudges asking you to reconsider. You have a pitcher for serving water to your guests, but do you have a pitcher designed especially for tea and lemonade? And it takes a tremendous amount of self-discipline to resist all those little nudges. In fact, there was a book, a popular book by this name a few years ago, Nudge, written by a couple of snappy Chicago economists. It was about how human beings don't always make the most rational decisions for themselves. You know, they studied IKEA. Much of our behavior is determined by the little nudges that we receive. To buy a stick of gum at the checkout counter. To take a car wash with that tank of gas. To water my lawn like my neighbors do. The book was about all the positive possibilities associated with nudges. The authors argued that social policy could be designed to encourage us to make better choices for ourselves. You know, an employee plan to save for retirement. Or maybe the preferential arrangement of healthy food in the cafeteria so that one would be more likely to choose healthy options. But this got me thinking because depending on the Bible that you read, there are also little nudges throughout the text. Maybe you've noticed those helpful headings in your study Bible. I really like these headings because they make it possible to find your way through a passage or to find a passage that's kind of difficult to locate. But you have to be attentive because these headings have a lot of interpretive power. For better or for worse, a simple phrase associated with the passage might nudge us to read the story with a particular lens. Take, for example, the heading in my Bible for this week's text. David commits adultery with Bathsheba. The heading gives you an idea of the content of the story. There will be two characters, David and Bathsheba. The heading gives away that the content of the story will feature an adulterous scandal. And the heading seems to imply that the fault is mainly David's. David is the one, according to the heading, who commits adultery. Well, then you read the story. Uriah the Hittite is off at battle, fighting David's war with the Philistines. And for reasons unspecified, the king has not taken his usual place at the front of battle. Instead, he has spent the spring months back home. Lounging on his rooftop, he spies a beautiful woman, and he sends for her and sleeps with her and soon learns that she has become pregnant. And that's problematic for the king, because Uriah, the husband, has been gone off to war so long that there's no way that he could possibly be the father. So David summons Uriah back from the front, hosts him at the palace with lots of food and wine, and then sends him home drunk to Bathsheba, hoping that when the child is born, Uriah will assume that he is the father. But rather than indulge in all this flattery, Uriah turns out to be an especially honorable man. He feels conflicted about enjoying all of these luxuries and pleasures while his friends and comrades are in the discomfort of battle. "The servants of my lord are camping in an open field," Uriah says. "Shall I then go to my house and to eat and to drink and lie with my wife?" See, the story holds in contrast the purity of Uriah's intentions with the selfish motives of David. And since David's problem is not yet resolved, he asks Uriah to carry a sealed message back with him to the front. The letter contains orders to Uriah's commander, Joab, to put Uriah on the leading line of battle and then fall back from him. Uriah unknowingly carries his death warrant, and he dies by enemy fire on the open field that he had pledged to the king to protect. And Bathsheba has one line of dialogue in the whole narrative. It's a simple declarative sentence delivered to the king: "I am pregnant." And from there, she disappears from the story until the very end, when she receives news of her husband's death from the battlefield, and she enters a dark period of mourning. Now think about that heading that we read. David commits adultery with Bathsheba. Is that really what happened in the story? The sexual encounter at the center of this narrative is extramarital, but adultery usually implies consent. And the narrative omits any conversation that David and Bathsheba might have had. I suppose it's possible that the storyteller is leaving to our imagination the seduction and the foreplay. If you add some details to the story, maybe we could make it a story about adultery. But all the details that we have are details about actions that David takes. Examine the verbs to see who has power here. The verbs in the story are strong, and they are associated with Israel and with the king. Israel ravaged the Ammonites. Israel besieged Rabbah. And then all the verbs turn to David himself. David saw. David said. David sent. What about Bathsheba? If it takes two, what does she have to say about all this? Crickets. The one verb ascribed to Bathsheba, conceived. But the text doesn't even say Bathsheba conceived. The text writes her out of the narrative. It says, the woman conceived. And when Bathsheba actually has her one line of dialogue, she uses the passive verb to be. I am pregnant. She didn't give consent. She lacked power to give consent. Because of David's high status, she would have been unable to give consent if she had wanted to. You can't say no to the king when the king calls you. The headings in my Bible use adultery as a euphemism here. Or maybe it's just wishful thinking. We have to call this what it is. David raped her. You know, I've heard this story many, many times before, but the first time I heard David's conduct called rape was 6 years ago. My senior colleague, Matt Martis LaCroix, included it in a carefully researched sermon. And it was jarring for me to hear it called for what it was. Maybe I'm as invested as anyone in a Bible that is sanitized of difficult passages. And a few people have told me this summer that they have lost respect for King David after reading the stories about him. And maybe I was trying to hang on as well to the myth of David's virtuosity. But I think I was resistant to calling this what it was also because my reading of the Bible has been shaped persistently by all the things that I have heard said about it. By what I learned in Sunday school. By the teachings that I have received. By those headings that aren't so non-invasive. It's not at all unlike the stories that we hear every day. You know, we are surrounded by nudgers. Every day is another float down this lazy river under the influence of those interests that want to shape how we see the world. Not everybody always wants to call a thing what it really is. It takes a lot of courage and presence to raise a hard question. And I think this is a central problem with Christianity. Christian people tend to be taught what a story means before they are taught the content of the story. We have so much to learn from Jewish people in this way. Jewish people who take so much more freedom in the enjoyment of a story's mysteries. I've never met a rabbi who actually answered a question that I had about a story. You know, they just told me another story. And that's why Jesus is famous for his parables. Because what we need more than answers is a deep sense of wonder. What we need more than quick fixes and easy resolutions is a commitment to stick with the hard questions. A commitment to pay attention to the story. And when I read this story in its biblical setting, I notice that the Hebrew doesn't call David's behavior anything. The original text doesn't call it adultery, and it doesn't call it rape. It just presents the story as if to raise the question to the reader, what do you make of this? What would you call this? Nudges aren't all that bad. The headings in your story can be helpful, and we can nudge each other to do good. In fact, I think we rely upon the encouragement of one another. But it's also true that we take influence for granted. And it's a discipline to remain awake and attentive. Do I really need this plastic tube of bath salts? But more seriously, am I really hearing what I think I'm hearing? Is this story really about what they say it's about? What would it take for me to be more present and responsible in this moment? Amen.